And before we get too far into talking about glam rock in the 70s, let's just listen. The band is called John's Children. The song is called Desdemona.
Desdemona.
So the voice is that of Mark Bolan, who later reached his peak of fame with T-Rex. He gets lots of ink in the book Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. It is the work of Simon Reynolds, a British native living in Los Angeles and a prolific writer on music. His shorter works appear in the likes of the New York Times and the Guardian, but he's also the author of 7 books about music and pop culture, including books on the post-punk period and the rave movement. Simon Reynolds, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Great to be with you.
It's a fun tour that you take us on through this book and into glam rock. And you start with a personal thing, watching the glam acts on the Top of the Pops. Tell us what you were seeing when you were where we led.
Well, the sort of center of British pop culture for decades, really, particularly in the 70s, was this show, Top of the Pops, which was on every week. And, you know, like one in three people in Britain watched it, and you watch it with your family, so your dad might be watching it with you, complaining about the, you know, pop groups, men wearing makeup and too much long hair, and you know, there'd be a lot of middle of the road kind of stuff on, but there'd also be these weirdos, and that's what I remember as a 9-year-old, 10-year-old, is these strange groups dressed in foil, you know, like in the case of Gary Glitter, with spangles on their cheekbones and you know, just outrageously camp and sometimes science fictional kind of looking image, almost like a parody of glamour more than actual glamour in the conventional sense of looking kind of chic and razzle dazzly. A kind of an absurdist cartoon of glamour is what, you know, T-Rex and Slade and Bowie and so many other groups, Sparks from L.A., you know, it was a wonderful time to grow up as a pop kid.
Well, you know, any music seems to be, at least in part, a reaction to what came before it. So what was glam a reaction to or a movement against?
Well, rock in the late, you know, in the late 60s, really from Sgt. Pepper onwards and groups like Cream and Hendrix, it was the sort of golden age of the album, and rock matured as an art form, and it took on, you know, thanks to Dylan in large influence, took on very serious subjects. It, you know, it got into sort of adult themes, and it was all about albums. And, you know, it's a golden period for rock music in lots of ways, but what was lost was the pop element. And, you know, some bands started not even bothering to release singles, Led Zeppelin famously, and after an initial pop period, Pink Floyd just wouldn't release singles anymore. It was all about the album, and you were supposed to sort of sit and contemplate the profound lyrics and, you know, these sort of album-length, thematically linked works in a lot of cases. And so the pop thing really dropped away, and glam was sort of returned to the single, to sort of rock and roll you could dance to, and to sort of idols, you know, these sort of pretty boys in the main who teenagers could scream at and sort of obsess over. So it was sort of the return of pop, but as music, it actually rocked really hard. It was like, you know, great riffs, great sort of stompy beats and anthemic choruses.
Well, and so one of the greater examples, as you mentioned, the Pretty Boys at the heart of this, we get to Mark Bolan, who we've heard from already, but now we get to hear from him as part of T-Rex. And okay, I'm pretty sure to this date I understand what Get It On means, but the Bang a Gong part, was that just sort of code for something else?
He loved to do these sort of little nonsense rhymes, and they call it Bang a Gong in the States because there was another record out at that time called Get It On. But yeah, and in the UK it's known as Get It On. He just, you know, a lot of his songs were like little nursery rhymes, psychedelic nursery rhymes, with wonderful sort of love lyrics in them, like, you know, you've got the universe reclining in your hair, these sort of rather purple paeans to girls. And, you know, the teenage fans of T-Rex just could sort of slot themselves into the lyrics as the object of Mark's worship, and they in turn worshipped him.
What was it that influenced Mark Bolan? What made him into the musician he was, and I guess more importantly, the showman that he was?
Well, when you play the John's Children record, that was sort of a group that were, he was the one of the main songwriters, and he did the backing vocals in that. And they were sort of like a mod group. They were kind of a bit like The Who, very chaotic. Then he became like a hippie, and he was sort of very influenced by Lord of the Rings and Tolkien. And, you know, so he wrote loads of these sort of jangly acoustic hippie songs about elves and fairies and stuff. And then by the time of T-Rex, he sort of realized he really didn't want to be a cult artist on the hippie underground. He wanted to be a pop star. And so he picks up electric guitar, and he rediscovers his love of early rock and roll and 12-bar blues and things like that. And that's sort of what he translates into pop, into these perfect, you know, he had the one hit wonder in the States, but in Britain he had about 12 top 10 hits, 5-6 number ones. You know, he was like the biggest thing since the Beatles, really.
Well, and as you point out, I mean, there were groups like the Rolling Stones that paved some of the road toward the way Mark Bolan did it in T-Rex and glam rock.
Yeah, in Shock and Awe, I kind of wanted to, you know, give the Stones props for being the original rock and roll dandies. You know, they were the first, I think they were the first rock group to put on women's clothing for this song, Have You Seen Your Mother, Baby Standing in the Shadows, where, you know, on the single cover and in the promo film that came with it, they're sort of dragged up in female clothing. They wore makeup in a promo for Jumping Jack Flash, I think it was. So, you know, they parted, you know, there was a big camp pretty boy element to particularly Jagger and Brian Jones in the Stones. So, yeah, I think the Stones were the pioneers of that in lots of ways. And then Bowie and Bolan took it much, much further.
We will talk more about glam rock and where it went with David Bowie and others in Simon Reynolds' book, Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. T-Rex to the break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about glam rock from the 1970s with the prolific British and now living in Los Angeles music writer Simon Reynolds. His latest book is called Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about T-Rex and David Bowie and many more. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the Stones getting a part of this. I mean, did anybody actually just come out and say, hey, androgyny is a good marketing technique?
Well, I think there was a little bit of an element to that with Bowie. I mean, I think he was naturally very pretty and delicate looking, and having long hair was part of the 60s thing. But, you know, I think Bowie could have realized he needed a kind of a publicity gimmick to sort of push him over, and that's where his famous 1972 declaration that I'm gay and I always have been came in. You know, I think there was an element where he was genuinely sort of fascinated by gay culture and had learned a lot from it. He hung out with on the gay club scene in London, and he was very inspired by Warhol and that sort of whole factory glamour and decadence kind of scene that he sort of read about and watched, you know, remotely. From the other side of the Atlantic. But I think there was a big element of I need something to really grab the headlines. And in those days, it was very unusual. I think it was completely unknown, really, for a pop star, a rock star, to sort of say so explicitly, I'm gay. And, you know, he was exaggerating quite a bit.
Sure, yeah, ahead of his time, certainly, in doing that. While we're talking about... go ahead.
No, as a sort of gimmick, it kind of was both, you know, helped to make him a star, and it was also actually very liberating for people to, you know, who were emerging into their sexuality in the 70s to have a major pop star say something like I'm gay and as a very cool thing to be, you know. I think that was quite a revolutionary statement of his.
Indeed it was, and expressed in songs like this one.
Hot tramp, I love you so. We'll be right back.
David Bowie singing Rebel Rebel. You talked about some of the other influences that led up to glam rock, but David Bowie mentioned being influenced by Anthony Newley, who is a name not well known, I think, in today's world, but was a big deal in Britain at the time.
Yeah, initially Bowie saw himself as being like an all-round entertainer, and he wanted to do like musicals, and he wanted to write musicals and actually be on the stage in London. He wanted to be in films. You know, he was very much almost like a cabaret concept of himself as a performer, which is what Anthony Newley was. Anthony Newley, you know, did some rock and roll singles, but he was also in movies. He was on TV in a very surreal, ahead of its time TV show called The Strange World of Gurney Slade. But then he was like a sort of Las Vegas cabaret performer, and he wrote musicals. And so he was like, that was sort of the ideal that Bowie initially, you know, imagined he'd be doing, was something like, you know, an all-round entertainer. And then I think he realized that, you know, he sort of took on rock and roll as a sort of phase, you know, as a way to become famous. And in fact, if you look at his career, he did go on Broadway. He was in loads of films. He probably has the best film career of any rock star.
But you know, there's an interesting line in here, and there are times your text gets fairly sharp about the people who were the main protagonists of glam rock. And you bring up Oscar Wilde's question, is insincerity such a terrible thing? And say that question would pretty well predict David Bowie's career.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of rock music is sort of based on the idea of authenticity, and like the idea that who you are on stage is more or less a reflection of your real life, and your songs draw from your experience. And Bowie's concept of art, really, of performance and what he did, was much more like, I can be anything I want to be, and I can change roles. So each album through the 70s was like a whole new persona. Each album concert tour was like a whole new persona, a whole new look, and often whole new kind of lyrical preoccupations as well. So his idea was that you just could reinvent yourself, and you didn't have to have some kind of core personality. So I sort of see him in a way as like, you know, like the opposite of Bowie would be someone like Neil Young, who more or less is pretty much the same all the way through. You know, it's the same kind of ideas, same musical approaches. Bowie was like, you know, this album I'm going to be, you know, with Young Americans, it was, I'm going to be funk and soul. Then he gets interested in German music, and that's the records he made in Berlin, like Low and Heroes. You know, he just did not feel tied to an identity.
Simon Reynolds, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book about glam rock in the 70s and its influences up to today is called Shock and Awe. So did Bowie hasten the demise of glam rock by changing genres himself, or had it pretty much run its course? I'm curious to know, particularly when T-Rexstacy kind of burned out.
T-Rexstacy was really pretty fast-moving phenomenon. I mean, it was like 2 years, really, of it being at sort of white heat. And then it kind of, you know, it sort of fades fairly quick, and he starts to, you know, starts to seem rather a sad figure. Bowen actually tried to jump, you know, he was ahead of Bowie in sort of doing the funk and soul thing, but he didn't make a successful a kind of transition to it. And so he sort of reverted to his original sound. I think the peak of glam is probably like 3 years. Bowie left it pretty quickly. But there's a sort of second phase when you have groups like Sparks and Queen. Early Queen is quite glam. A group, Cockney Rebel, who are mainly known for the song Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile. But were actually a really interesting, weird, arty, theatrical group. There's a sort of second phase of glam that sort of goes up almost right up to punk.
Well, and there are people you include in here that I'm a little surprised by. So here's the song called Elected, and we can figure it out from here. Yankee Doodle Dandy and a gold Rolls Royce. Alice Cooper, I was really surprised to find him in a glam rock book because his vibe was a bit different.
Well, I think nowadays people tend to lump Alice Cooper in with was one of the godfathers of metal, you know, and sort of a venerated elder like Ozzy Osbourne, who does these tours and still pulls big crowds. But at the time, he was very much considered in the same sort of breath as Bowie and Lou Reed and New York Dolls and groups like that. He did wear women's clothing very early on in some of his stage performances, and he had a very strong kind of theatrical element. It was more of a sort of horror cartoon, grotesque kind of thing than the theatricality of Bowie, which was more like sort of glamorous decadence and dystopian futures. But he was pioneering in terms of turning rock into theatre. And I think also his music was very, the Alice Cooper singles are like brilliant sort of punchy, hard riffing, glam era singles. I think they're very much coming from the same place as groups like, The Sweet and Bolan and other groups of that time, Susie Quattro. It's tough, it's tough, punchy, anthemic rock.
And that's the stuff that's a little hard to reconcile sometimes in talking about glam, particularly as I was looking at music videos to choose out some clips to play on the show. I mean, these guys could play and they could rock pretty hard, but at the same time, they're wearing what looks like Mylar or shiny clothing anyway, and their hair is all poofed out and wearing a lot of makeup, too.
Yes, I mean, it was a golden period, I think, for the cosmetic counters in places like Boots, the bit, which is the big store in Britain that sells medicine and makeup and things like that. Some of them were better than others. Bowie actually studied with a master cosmetologist, and I found a hilarious piece in Cream magazine, which was the one American magazine that really supported glam in America. Rolling Stone was a little bit sniffy about it, I think. And there's a hilarious piece where Bowie's talking about how to, apply eye makeup and, how he used to draw something on his forehead, like a golden makeup image, symbol. But one time he shaved his eyebrows and it all dribbled into his eyes and blinded him. It was all about Bowie's tips on makeup. But other people kind of applied it with almost like a trowel, like really crude splodges of mascara and rouge, and looked kind of not gorgeous in the way that Bowie did.
Simon Reynolds, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about glam rock is Shock and Awe. And if you have some memories of glam rock you'd like to share with us, join us at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. The way pop music tends to work, though, I mean, a couple of people do things a little differently, and then that becomes a genre, and suddenly everybody pretty much has to do that to get into the mainstream. Was there that period in glam when you pretty much had to be a glam band to get recognized, to get on the top of the pops and so forth?
Well, that's actually one of the things I kind of wanted to put in the book, but I didn't have space. It's rather a long book as it is, but there was a rather hilarious period when a lot of musicians who really were not suitable for the glam image would appear on album covers with this stuff on, like Edgar Winter, the blues musician Edgar Winter. Mm-hmm. There's an album cover where he's covered in makeup and is wearing silver lame jeans, I think. Donovan of all people tried to do a sort of glam record. There was a lot of bandwagon jumping at that time, and then there were bands who stood against it, like the Eagles were very disparaging of sort of gimmick groups, theatrical groups who depended on sort of stage stunts and I think they had Alice Cooper in mind, they had Bowie in mind, and the New York Dolls, and they had a whole little thing they called Song Power, where they were like, our music speaks for itself and we don't need to dress up.
I'm having
had T-shirts made with the words Song Power on them.
That's an interesting reaction. I have a little hard time wrapping my mind around this, the singer of Try and Catch the Wind getting into a glam rock thing, but I'm sure it happened. Donovan had quite a few different personas. I want to come back to Alice Cooper for just a second, the chicken story. Shall we deal with the chicken story?
Well, there's something happened on stage in, I think it was Toronto, at a big rock festival, where a chicken made its way onto stage and Alice Cooper threw it into the audience, and the audience didn't know it was real, and it got torn to bits. And the story just grew and grew until the idea was that, people were saying Alice Cooper tears apart a chicken on stage. No one really knows if that chicken was deliberately introduced onto stage by the manager of Alice Cooper, Shep Gordon, but certainly it blew up into this tale of depravity, and Frank Zappa, who was at that time putting out the Alice Cooper records on his label, phoned them up and said, for goodness sake, even if it's not true, don't say it's not true. There's one of the things that was interesting about glam, I think, was that it was a lot of use of hype and sort of fable and fiction to sort of generate controversy. And some of the people involved in it, particularly Shep Gordon, the manager of Alice Cooper, were maestros of creating publicity out of bad, you know. It wasn't just that, you know, bad, there's no such thing as bad publicity. They would actively try and create bad publicity.
Oh, wow, because they figured there's no bad publicity, yeah, as you said. Okay. Another example from this period, and you ticked off this name as part of a list earlier. Let's hear a little bit from Slade. All right, so Slade is probably a pretty good example. The song is called We're All Crazy Now, and it's spelled strangely. But Slade was huge then, but historically, where have they landed?
Well, they never really made it in America. I think they maybe had a small hit, like in the 1980s or something. But they were like monster huge in Britain. I mean, they were the biggest selling of all those glam era groups. They had like 6 number ones, 12 top 10 hits. Bigger even than Mark Bolan. But for some reason, they couldn't quite find a foothold in the States. They sort of fell in between the FM radio and the AM radio thing. But they were great group. They started out, like a lot of these people, were actually relatively old for pop stars by the time they broke through as glam. And they'd been through the whole 60s thing. They'd had long hair. They were doing sort of vaguely progressive music. And then they did realize, we need to simplify this. Actually, simpler is better and stronger. So they've kind of brought their music down to this sort of stomping beat with hand claps, and they actually would add stomping feet sounds to their records. And these sort of great hooks, and Noddy Holder, the singer, singing always at this sort of, you know, 10 or 11 on the amplifier kind of level, like a blast, a foghorn blast. They were a dance band, is the other thing. Like so many of the glam groups, it was all about the beat, and they would, you know, drive their audiences into a frenzy, stomping and shouting and clapping along. So, they're a great band, Slade.
Interesting too in the video that came with that clip, the attire of the band members seems to split a line between Space Invaders and the Bay City Rollers.
Yes, they had this whole, you know, one of the guys really, you know, the guitarist Dave Hill really was into the whole silver thing and the giant platform boots and almost, yeah, like a science fiction 1950s B-movie kind of look. And then the other look is very hard to describe. It's sort of like a British yokel of the 18th century that Noddy Holder had, where he's kind of wearing a waistcoat and a strange little cap. And it's sort of like working men's. Uh-huh. Image in a way, but it does, as you say, it does look ahead to the Bay City Rollers look. So I think there was a big connection between Slade and the Bay City Rollers and soccer fans. You know, there was a kind of a lot of the chants in their songs resemble the kind of chants you would get at big soccer matches.
So did glam rock burn out simply because the people who listened to it got older and their tastes changed, do you think?
I think, you know, there were a bunch of reasons why every fad kind of, every sort of big music fashion kind of has its obsolescence point where it's, you know, it's the ideas have been used up. You're getting a lot of people jumping on the bandwagon, kind of diluting it. And the key people in it are shrewd enough to realize they can't stick with this. They need to move on. So Bowie moved on, Roxy Music moved mm-hmm. on. I think also what happened was, you know, by the mid-70s, there was, A lot of glam was about fantasy and leaving the real world and into this sort of dream space. And there was a call for a more kind of gritty street music that reflected sort of the rather grim realities of 70s life. And that's where punk rock came into it. Musically, punk rock is almost like an extension of glam, but it's all about reality and politics and serious things, you know. And the sort of problems kids face rather than the fantasies that glam was about.
All right. So we have just scratched the surface of what you pointed out as a very big book. It's called Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. Simon Reynolds wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Simon, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely a pleasure. And we close now with a song written by David Bowie, but performed by Mötley Hoople. This is All the Young Dudes. To take us to the break, we'll return with Josh Gross and Rogue Sounds for the month of February.
Too many snacks. Nah, I drunk a lot of wine and I'm feeling fine.